From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Today on the show, a look at how to make roads safer for pedestrians in one of the most deadly counties for walkers in Georgia.
It's going to take some time to fix the problems that we have, but if we don't start now, when are we going to start?
Also, we're going to learn about learning. Do students learn better if more money is spent on schools? That's not the case with one Georgia academy. It received millions of dollars, but state education officials gave it a D rating. We'll go inside the Georgia Cyber Academy. That's coming up this hour, but first, we talked yesterday about Georgia's changing demographics and how the state might turn purple in this year's presidential election. Georgia State University professor Dan Franklin says Hillary Clinton could potentially win the state's 16 electoral votes.
It is possible, and one of the things to look for in this race is to see where the campaigns go to do their campaigning. If we see either one of the candidates down in Georgia doing anything other than fundraising, the Republicans are in real trouble because this should be a reliably red state.
And we asked if you think Hillary Clinton has a chance at being the first Democrat to win Georgia since her husband did in 1992. Here are your first thoughts. Thomas Hayes writes on Twitter, "This election has been full of unexpected turns since the beginning. I don't think we should be surprised that Clinton wins Georgia. I mean, old precedents don't seem to hold as much sway because of Trump mobilizing voters. All states up for grabs." We'll see. Bob Bailey tweets, "In this particular race, if Georgia can't swing, then I will be ashamed of my state because it will send a message that we have no conscience." Dang. Linda Rickert Exum writes on Facebook, "Might happen because Trump is so dangerous." And Shirley Harrison Rogers says, "Hillary will follow Obama so she will get the black vote. If they're not registered, then they don't vote." I think maybe Shirley there is referring there to the fact that many thousands of African-American voters registered to vote for Obama, and thus they have been brought into the process. Could affect things down the line. We always want to know what you think. Call us at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSTTalk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. Macon Bibb County officials meet later this month to discuss why the rate of pedestrian fatalities is so high in the city. It's either the most deadly or close to the most deadly county in the state for walkers, depending on how you count it. Esther Muhammad's son Daniel was hit by a car on Macon's east side when he was just 16 years old.
The way Jeffersonville Road is made, it's a blind spot when you're coming from a certain distance, especially if the sun is beaming, and she didn't see him.
Daniel Muhammad survived that crash, but he was struck again 3 years ago near the family's East Macon apartment, and that time he died from his injuries. Muhammad was a well-known and much-loved young man around town. He was a poet who was prominent in the downtown creative scene, and his death made a lot of news. What the public didn't know is that police later quietly determined that Muhammad's death was a suicide. His mom does not believe it. That part of the story was reported by one of my journalism students at Mercer University, Connor Wood. She and her classmates did a semester-long investigation into Macon's sky-high pedestrian fatality rate that we hope advanced the discussion on the topic and perhaps had something to do with city officials' decision to convene a summit on the topic later this month. We're going to talk now about Macon's problem, which has a lot in common with the problems of other urban communities across the Southeast and beyond. Joining me in Macon's Southeast and beyond. Joining me in GPB's Macon Bureau is my friend Chris Savadawa. Chris chairs the Health Services Administration Program at Middle Georgia State University, and he sits on the Macon Bibb Board of Health, where he has made pedestrian safety a top issue. Hey, Chris.
Good morning, Adam.
Also joining us all the way from Cleveland, Ohio, which has its own struggles with this problem, is Angie Schmidt. She's editor of Streets Blog USA, a publication that follows urban transportation issues. Welcome back to the show, Angie.
Thanks a lot.
Chris, let's just start with you. This is a problem that at most, at the worst years in Macon, has killed maybe a dozen people. The rate of fatalities compared to other communities is very high in Macon, but the amount of deaths that we're talking about is relatively small compared to other things that hurt people in our community. Why is this something that deserves so much attention from people like you?
Well, pedestrian fatalities and injuries are such a significant indicator of an intersection of larger problems. You look at infrastructure, behavior, enforcement, and you see that an opportunity presents itself for policymakers to possibly lead the discussion, bring in science, bring in More inquiry into past the anecdotal assessment of one accident at one time, and you see that this is something that can be prevented. It's something that we should expect is an unacceptable outcome on our roadways. And just like other changes in pedestrian and driver safety, such as seatbelt use or drunk driving, we in public health and as a citizenry have decided that this is unacceptable, and we need to move this conversation around pedestrian safety and bike safety into that same sphere.
Angie, when you look at the national numbers, what are they doing? Are more people being hit by cars while they're out walking, or is it holding steady? Is it actually declining in some places?
Actually, in the last few years, it's been growing after a number of years of decline. And nobody's really sure why, in particular, pedestrian and cycling deaths are on the way up. Just in the last year, overall motor vehicle fatalities spiked because, in large part, because gas prices are so low and more people are out driving.
Out there driving, yeah. One of the interesting things that we discovered in our reporting here in Macon, Angie, was that if you looked at the rates of fatalities across different areas of our city, we saw that a lot of people were hit by cars in our downtown area, but those strikes very rarely resulted in fatalities. Where people get hit and killed is in the immediately outlying suburban areas. Does that surprise you, or is that consistent?
No, not at all. That's very common. These pedestrian fatalities are very closely related to driver speed. So if a pedestrian is hit by a car traveling at 20 miles per hour, they almost always survive. The death rate is very low. But if they're hit by a car traveling 40 miles per hour, they almost always die. So speed is a very key factor in pedestrian safety. And on a lot of these outlying roads, they're built sort of like highways in the city.
Right.
Even though they might be near things people want to walk to or near apartment buildings where people are relying on transit, often they've been designed with a lot of highway-like features that really speed cars fast. And those are the most dangerous. Those suburban arterials are definitely the most kind of dangerous kind of road for pedestrians.
Chris Savatowa, when we look at the places in Georgia where pedestrian fatality rates are very high, it's places like Macon, it's places like Augusta, Richmond, it's some of the Atlanta counties. What do all these places have in common? It's not just that they're urbanized, right?
No, I mean, you can attribute a lot of, these issues to, a variety of different things, but I'll speak to one of those that's about those cities. An intersection of federal interstates, state roads, and then large municipalities. And so that makes the problem a little bit more complex when you look at how do you resolve this from a jurisdictional perspective.
Right, because cities can't just go in and change state or federal roads.
Right, you can't even go out there and restripe it when no one's looking. So, it makes it a pretty complicated process, not one that is necessarily laden with red tape, but one that requires you to have real purpose and strategy. And if you don't have someone managing, a plan, and you don't have a citizenry, being vocal about their expectations, it makes it very difficult for you to move past, these incremental adjustments for road redesign or construction or just day-to-day use.
Sure, yeah. Listeners, we're talking about pedestrian safety. Macon is going to be convening a summit later this month to look at its particular problem with pedestrian fatalities. And my guests are Angie Schmidt. She's the editor of Streets Blog USA. Chris Savatowa is a board member of the Macon Bibb Board of Health. We'd love to hear from you. How is pedestrian safety where you live? What do you think can be done to improve safety for walkers? Tweet us at OST Talk or join our conversation happening at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Let's talk about solutions. We spoke to Peter Norton. He's a technology historian at the University of Virginia. He's also author of the book Fighting Traffic, The Dawn of the Motor Age in the American City. He says, in some ways, all the rules of the road that motorists and pedestrians follow put them in harm's way. He points to a town in the Netherlands that made a major traffic change. Let's listen.
Beginning in a town called Drachten, they took out all the traffic lights, all the stop signs. They took away the curbs, so you can't tell the difference between the sidewalk and the street. They only put up one rule sign, and that was a sign that said, there are no rules here, so be careful. And what they found was that suddenly drivers were much more careful. pedestrians had a better experience, and actually the number of injuries and fatalities fell.
So, Angie, this is sort of similar to a lot of different strategies that I've heard about. One is called a road diet, where you take a wide road and actually make it more narrow. All these things that would seem to, on their face, to actually make the roads more dangerous, and yet they somehow result in fewer accidents. Square this circle for us.
Yeah, the sort of norm in traffic engineering for a long time was to design roads a lot like highways. What's safe on a highway is wide lanes. But it turns out in urban areas, the exact opposite is the safest. These wide lanes encourage cars to drive very fast, and that's the worst possible thing for pedestrian safety. And it's also more dangerous for motorists. So a lot of cities that are tackling these issues, they're using this technique called a road diet. A lot of them are adding bike infrastructure. So you can take a four-lane road, for example, and make it into a three-lane road with a center turn lane and add two bike lanes. And not only does that give people a new option, a new healthy option about how to get around, a lot of times it doesn't even slow traffic. It improves the efficiency for drivers, and it's safer for everyone. So adding bike infrastructure is a really great tool you can use in this to solve this problem.
Right. So we have a Facebook message from a listener named Brandon Winfrey, who says, teach everyone the laws of crosswalks and the laws of jaywalking. That's something that we hear a lot when we have these conversations, but it's actually contrary to the research that we're talking about, which is that really, what's necessary is for motorists to be awake and aware of their surroundings and ready for anything, as opposed to kind of sinking into that mindset where they're almost on autopilot. And having a road environment where there's lots of people crossing, lots of action, not that many signs, and people just have to figure things out for themselves, it actually tends to make things a little bit safer. Chris Savatawa, in our last minute here, with this summit that you've got coming up, what are you hoping to accomplish, and what kind of solutions is Macon looking at?
Well, you know, we're dedicated to defining the county's pedestrian safety concerns and laying out a strategy for making our community much safer. And we've recognized that by pulling together this pedestrian fatality review board that came out of a recommendation from the Board of Health and the county commissioners, that we were not alone and that many stakeholders were doing things and many entities in government and outside of government were doing things. So, you know, bringing together the resources to do road safety audits, to do open streets events, to do some real aggressive community education, that we know that we can really change the conversation. And that conversation actually has been changing, Adam. Our community no longer looks at victim blaming as the default approach to these injuries and fatalities.
And we'll have to leave it there. That's Chris Savatawa. He's on the board of public health for Macon-Bibb County. Angie Schmidt is the editor of Streets Blog USA. Check out her site. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headley. Georgia's largest public school is not located in Atlanta, it's not in Savannah or in Macon, it is online. More than 13,000 students attend the Georgia Cyber Academy. Last year, the school received $82 million in public funding. But despite that investment, state education officials recently gave the academy a D rating. It's one of the lowest grades given to a Georgia public school. Here to explain what's going on is Ty Tagami. He's a staff writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he covered the story. Good morning, Ty.
Good morning, Adam. Thanks for
having
me.
Good to have you. Also with us is Jennifer Rice. She's an Associate Dean of Education Policy and Leadership at the University of Maryland. Virtual education is one of the things that she studies. Thanks for being here, Professor.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Ty, let's just start with you. What's going on with this school? Where is it failing? Or not failing. It's a D rating, right? So where is it nearly failing?
The school has... across the board, it's gotten low scores, and the state uses a variety of measures from what they call the growth model to value-added model to assess performance. And it's done well in a few areas, notably high school literature, English classes. But for the most part, it has not surpassed the state or even equaled the state's performance on a variety of most of the measures are derived from test scores ultimately.
Test scores, yeah, sure. Jennifer Rice, when you look at virtual schooling across the country, do virtual schools tend to do as well as brick-and-mortar schools?
You know, they don't. In fact, I wasn't at all surprised to see the results of the Georgia Cyber Academy. I think that they are reflective of what we're seeing nationally. You know, on a national scale, only about 18% of virtual schools outperform state averages. And on-time graduation rates are similarly problematic, where we see about 41% on-time graduation rates in virtual school settings compared to 81% across the country.
Wow. Well, we'll talk about why that is in a minute, but let's sort of dig more into what's going on at Georgia Cyber Academy. Ty, what are state officials going to do about this? I mean, surely a D rating from the governor's office comes with some consequences, right?
It's going to take some time. So they are at their charter school, and charter schools operate on five-year contracts. They signed their contract in 2014-15, the 14-15 school year. So that was the first year. They've just completed the second year. The scores, you know, the state has something called the College and Career Ready Performance Index. That's going to take, you know, a while to calculate. So even though the test results just came out, we don't really know how this school performed on the goals in its contract. And it can run through 2019 before anything happens.
Right. Are there improvements? I mean, are there plans for improvements that school officials have talked about?
Yes. The school officials have said that one of their big problems is turnover. So students will come and then they will leave. And as you can imagine, an online schooling environment is a lot different from the traditional classroom. They argue that it takes time to adapt to that method of learning and that students who are with them for more than a year mm-hmm. do better. And so consequently, they've hired or they're planning to bring in more advisors to help coach newer families. They're also changing out their data system in middle school. Online learning is very data heavy. The teachers spend a lot of time inputting information about each kid into spreadsheets. And the school is trying to make it a little bit easier for the teachers to get useful information out of those data so that, you know, ultimately they use it to figure out what each kid needs so they can help them.
Ty, you've talked to some of the families of Georgia Cyber Academy students. How do they feel about all of this?
You find a real mix. And I think there's a core group of students who, I talked to, you know, teachers who said one of the issues they noticed is that only a small proportion of the class would attend regularly, was very engaged. And I think that goes back to the school's, you know, when the school was founded, it really appealed to the type of parent who wanted to be a homeschool parent, who was, you know, going to be home anyway, was teaching their kids, right, and maybe wanted to augment that with some formal curriculum. But over the years, they started with like 2,000 kids in 2007, and they've ballooned into what they are now. They were expecting 15,000 this fall. And I think a lot of those kids aren't coming from a homeschool background. So what you hear from parents is the parents who are really there, who have the financial, you know, flexibility, can stay at home and really coach their kids, they get a lot out of it. But it's the parents who aren't able to be there, who, you know, whose kids often fall behind.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. Have you or your kids enrolled in a virtual school? Do they work as effectively for you as traditional schools? Tweet us at OST Talk. We're talking about the Georgia Cyber Academy, which is the largest public school in Georgia. It's just received a D rating, or last academic year, it received a D rating from the governor's office, and it's struggling. And we're talking about virtual education with my guest, Ty Tagami, staff writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who's been reporting on this story. Also with us is Jennifer Rice, Associate Dean of Education Policy and Leadership at the University of Maryland. And Professor Rice, you said earlier that it is not at all uncommon for virtual schools to underperform relative to brick-and-mortar schools. Why do you think that is?
Well, let me expand on a couple of things and also echo some of the points that Ty made in the in a Georgia context. You know, it's I think one of the really interesting parts about the underperformance is that virtual schools tend to be serving lower concentrations of poor and minority students. So we would actually think that their scores and outcomes would be better than the U.S. average, which is that's one of the more striking findings. And I think to echo the Georgia context, it you know, the research tells us that really the only students who are successful in virtual schools tend to be students who are independently oriented toward learning. So students who you know have this independent and intrinsic motivation, exactly the kinds of students that Kai was describing, but also students who have strong management literacy, technology skills, and who have a strong parent support structure to help them through. So you know, it's a subset of all students, in fact, a rather small subset of all students who have the potential to do well in this virtual environment, you know, despite the promise that these schools can really individualize instruction and tailor that instruction to individual needs.
So that's who does well in a virtual school. Who ends up being in a virtual school? What are the types of students that these schools tend to get, and how do they end up there?
Well, they do tend to be students who are more affluent. They also tend to be the white students outnumber poor and minority students in virtual settings at the national level. So again, we would expect to see higher outcomes and scores in these contexts. And I also want to point out that you know the outcomes that we're talking about here are a very narrow band of the outcomes
that we really care about. Yeah, we're just talking about test scores, and we all know that's a big problem, right?
Exactly. Like, we expect schools to, you know, promote social, physical, psychological development of kids. And, you know, those are outcomes we're not even monitoring. So, you know, that I think that should raise
eyebrows. It's not like those are important.
Exactly. We should be paying attention to those as well.
Right, yeah. Let's turn to the issue of cost. As we mentioned, Georgia Cyber Academy got $82 million in public funding last year. That's a lot of money. On the other hand, it's an enormous student population, 13,000 students. Ty, do we have a sense of how much the per student spending compares at Georgia Cyber Academy as opposed to a normal public school?
Sure, that breaks down. The amount they get breaks down to about $5,000 per student, which is almost half what the typical public, you know, brick and mortar, they call them, traditional public school gets. Now, that's justified. Well, that occurs for a couple of reasons. One, it's a charter school under the state charter commission, which was just only recently created under a constitutional amendment. And that charter commission does not get local funding. The state tries to make that up with additional dollars, but it's not equivalent to what a traditional public school would get. So they start off at a lower level, and then the charter commission gives it's got three virtual charter schools, and it gives them about two-thirds what it gives its charter schools that have buildings. And that's, you know, the argument there is they don't have to fuel up buses, they don't have to cook lunches, they don't have to maintain buildings. So it's unclear whether they're getting the right amount, but I think the charter school would argue they aren't. But I don't see politically an interest in giving them more money at the moment.
Right, yeah. I want to play a clip from education advocate Daryl Bradford. He is bringing out some of the reasons here why some schools struggle with money. Let's listen.
Because we're spending on all the wrong things, like ridiculous facilities, right? Ridiculous, you know, bells and whistles that we don't need. And the most important things, like, you know, breaking a monopoly, empowering people with choice, focusing on teacher quality and compensation. We don't do that stuff. We're focusing on doing it now, but we haven't done it in the last, you know, 15 years.
So, Jennifer, some of those things may indeed be ridiculous, but the advantage of going with the Cyber Academy is that you're not dealing with ridiculous facilities or meritorious facilities or any facilities at all. It completely takes that out of the equation. Is there not some great potential there for cyber education to refocus money and resources into the things that really, really matter, which is instruction, right?
Well, one could argue that there's potential for that. But I want to go back to my comment before about the multiple outcomes.
Yeah.
And sometimes we need to gather people in the same place to realize the kind of, you know, social and physical and psychological outcomes that I was talking about. And sometimes we need to gather people in the same place to even realize the kind of academic outcomes that we've been talking about. So I don't think we can completely dismiss the importance of facilities and the importance of space and physical interaction when we're talking about the education of children. So, you know, that is my first response to the facilities comment. But the point is well taken that the most important investment that we make in schools is in teachers and in instruction more broadly. And so we do need to be paying attention to teachers, but I think that's another major shortcoming of cyber schools across the country, is that we don't have a very good sense of what a quality teacher is in those environments, what unique knowledge and skills cyber teachers need relative to brick and mortar teachers. And that speaks to the quality of teachers, but then there's the question of the quantity of teachers. And the very large comparative class sizes in cyber schools is one of the factors that allows for such low relative per pupil expenditures in those environments. You know, the national average class size, depending on how you calculate it, is somewhere between 16 and 20 students per class. In virtual schools, it's about 35, and in the for-profit virtual schools, we're talking about 44 on average. Wow. Students per teacher, and it's much greater in some contexts than others. So that is in large part what's driving down the per pupil expenditure. And, you know, is that an optimal number for cyber schools? Certainly the technology allows for higher class sizes, but we don't really have any strong empirical sense of what the appropriate class size is in those environments to realize the range of outcomes that we want to realize.
We're talking about virtual K-12 schooling here on Second Thought. That's Jennifer Rice you're hearing. She's an Associate Dean of Education Policy and Leadership at the University of Maryland. Also joined by Ty Tagami, staff writer at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, who has been looking at the Georgia Cyber Academy, the largest public school in the state. 13,000 students recently received a D rating from state officials. Not good news. Ty, the families that you talked to, what did they say about the social component of schooling and why they were comfortable keeping their students at home rather than putting them into a physical space where they would learn how to interact with other kids?
Well, look, people come to this school for online schools for a variety of reasons. It may be that they think their child would do best in an online setting at home. They may already have been homeschooled. Their child may be a victim of bullying at school, or maybe they're pursuing athletics at a high level. I think the Georgia Cyber Academy has someone going to the Olympics. A former student. So, wow. You know, the kids, there are kids who are looking for some real flexibility because they don't have to attend the online classes when they occur. They can go back and look, you know, watch them, view them on their own time. So they attend for a variety of reasons. What I did find talking to students is that many of them still missed the social interaction. You have a range, right? The kids who were homeschooled initially didn't get any social interaction except for their siblings. So some of them I talked to were just happy to have a teacher other than their parents and to be able to interact with the kids online.
Yeah.
But many of them still, especially those who'd been in public schools previously, did miss the social interaction. Now, the school tries to make up for that by hosting field trips around the state occasionally, you know, but those occur infrequently. The kids would also try to maybe meet up at a coffee shop. But again, that's just not the same as a daily interaction in a school, which that can also be a bad thing if it's a distraction. But that's what I noticed among the parents and kids. Matter of fact, one of the students I talked to who left the school after 1 year, he had an issue with his father was able to stay home initially, but his hours changed and he had to go to work. So the kid was home alone with maybe an older relative, and he started to he wasn't doing as well at school. And when his mom decided to put him back in public school, but when I talked to him and asked him, you know, what went wrong, he said he just didn't like being in front of a computer you know, all those days.
And I suppose one other factor might just simply be that there are families out there who live in very, very low-performing school districts, and this is just the better option.
Absolutely.
For them.
Right, right. There are places in our where last just minute no other here, option.
Sure, yeah, exactly. In our last minute here, Jennifer Rice, what is the role that you see virtual schooling playing going forward, or rather, what role should it fulfill?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question here because, you know, the theory behind online schooling is that it really does provide opportunities for students who are in a circumstance, and those circumstances vary broadly, where the public schools may not offer what it is they need. So It may be that they're in failing public schools. It may be that they're super high-achieving students who need access to more advanced curriculum and opportunities. It may be that they just think and operate a little bit differently at a different pace than other students. And so, you know, using technology and really harnessing the power of that technology into the curriculum makes a whole lot of sense. We shouldn't turn our backs on that. But I do think that the virtual school, the full-time virtual school environment, is across this country a little bit like the Wild West. We don't have a clear sense of what it costs to do this well, of what it takes to do this well, of how students respond to various treatments.
And we will
find
out.
We really don't even know what's going on across the country.
That's Jennifer
mobility.
Rice. We got to leave it there, Jennifer. I apologize. Jennifer Rice of the University of Maryland, Tai Tagami, writer for the AJC. You guys have been great. Thank you for that conversation. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee. Fusion is a popular word these days to describe food. It's used to describe cuisine that combines elements from different cultures. But Asha Gomez is not a fan. She's chef and owner of the restaurant Spice to Table in Atlanta. And she says the word fusion does not tell the full story of what's going on a plate, and it's time to get rid of it. Let's open the gripe bag.
I don't like things now compared to the way they used to be.
You know what really grinds my gears?
All this progress. Phooey!
Will you please tell me why?
That's the way it was and we liked it.
Get off my lawn!
The first time someone said my food was fusion, I almost found it to be, I don't want to use the word insulting, but it didn't sit well with me, because to me, fusion would mean the collision of two things coming together and something just exploding. But for me, my food is my evolution as a person. It's my evolution as a human being, as someone who has been fortunate enough to be called two very magical places that happen to be oceans and continents apart, home, the Indian South, a state called Kerala, which is kind of nestled between the Arabian Sea and the Indian Ocean. It was a huge city in the years of the spice trade. And the American South, Georgia, which I've called home for getting close to two decades now. I want the American palate to experience my sensibility through spice. And how I bring that spice forth is it could be through a burger. You know, I decided to add, you know, a smoky black cardamom to my burger and put cilantro and mint and bind it with chickpea flour. But I served it on a brioche bun. And the American sensibility, you know, they look at it and it's so familiar. But then when they eat it, it's like, oh, my gosh, this is a kebab on a bun. I think in the past, what has happened is we've had so many cuisines that have come to the table and we've had to dumb the food down because a lot of these people that came as immigrants before weren't necessarily trained chefs. It was a trade that they knew. They knew how to cook. They came here. They made a living with it. They assumed what the American palate wanted, dumbed the food down, and presented it. So much got lost in translation. I think this new generation of chefs that are at the forefront today bring forth a story that they can tell, and they're able to connect the dots for the diner. I hope that they don't always expect to see us on Buford Highway or on a buffet line for $4.99. It deserves to be elevated in the same way as French food would be or New American food would be. And I think the minute you use the word fusion, you lose the power. I understand that the definition in the English dictionary for fusion food is the coming together of two cuisines or more. But this, it's been so bastardized, and it's not been able to tell a complete story like it should. And that is the reason that I don't like that word.
Asha Gomez is chef and owner of Spice to Table in Atlanta. Representation is important in food, not only for the people who make it, but also for those who write about it. Back in May, Celeste Headley spoke with a panel of food writers about the importance of diversity. Joining that conversation was Nicole Taylor of the Hot Grease podcast, food and beer writer Dennis Byron, and Natalie Kang of Chinese Southern Belle. Celeste started the conversation by asking Natalie, an Asian American who is raised in the South, how well she thinks local food writing represents Georgia.
I think the writing, just like the food, reflects us and our experiences. So I use food as a gateway. You know, it connects people. It exposes us to place in history and culture. So it's really when I share about my own experiences and ask others to share and connect with food, it's really a reflection of us. Since I grew up in Atlanta, and it was a very different place back then with no Asian markets, and I was the only Asian face in school, it has certainly become more diverse. And I'm very excited about that. I mean, now we have the Buford Highway International Corridor, and we have all this interest in different kinds of ethnic food. So I'm certainly excited about the movement towards
that.
Now,
that's interest in the food, and that's availability of the food. But, Dennis, does that mean we're getting a diverse enough cast of food writers that can appreciate all the different tastes?
There's always room for that. But I don't know if there's a word enough that says, okay, now we're good. There's 50% this and there's 50% that, and we're it's split down the middle. I think it's just what your profession is, and if you do a good job at it, then that will usually diversify itself, be it a good writer or what you specialize in. So, like, I'm in the industry of beer. You call me A.L. Sharpton, actually. And I see it. I'm working in the beer industry, and it's working on diversity, but it doesn't have to be pushed or forced. I just so people's taste buds are really complimented and talked about, I think that's a good start to do it.
Let me play you a comment from writer and restaurant owner Eddie Wong. He has a TV show called Wong's World. Many people watch. He travels around the world in that show. He bridges cultures through food. And this is from an interview he did for KPCC in Los Angeles.
I think the most satisfying thing is to be understood. At Bauhaus, if I make a dish and an old grandmother comes in from Flushing and says, you know what, I read about this restaurant and I love it and it reminds me of Taiwan, that's beautiful. She understands my experience, and I understand hers. When people watch the show and they email me, I get emails, they say, I'm Puerto Rican, or I'm Ecuadorian, or I'm Jamaican, and I'm not just like you, but when I watch the show, I feel like this is my life. That makes me happy. That's why we do this.
What does it mean, Nicole? We've heard a lot of discussion about what it means to have representation, say, in Hollywood, in our movies, in our TVs, and recognizing faces that look like you and sound like you. Does that hold true for food writing as well?
Totally. I mean, when I open up glossy magazines or log onto the internet and I'm going to my favorite food websites and I don't see stories about myself and how I grew up in Georgia, I feel like, wait, hold up. You know, we contributed a lot to American food culture. Where are our stories? So it's totally important, just like it's in Hollywood or in music or any other industry, to have our voices or more so our stories around food in media, in all types of media.
Okay. So, Natalie, I just kind of want to find out where those limits are. Somebody, the editor of Fusion magazine, tweeted out a picture of an article saying, here's the best dumpling restaurants in New York. And he circled the byline, which was Chris Crowley, who you assume is a white guy. And I think his point is that we often hear people who are not of a culture maybe did not grow up eating dumplings. Is it possible that there are better prepared people to give reviews on dumplings? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, that's what's been frustrating, I guess, if we're going to be honest here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, because I love the work that Nicole is doing. I think it comes down to how we're defining authenticity, who's defining it, and then who are we allowing to say, you know, what is authentic. And what has been a little frustrating in my journey is to see that these different kinds of ethnic foods are becoming popular, but they had to be first legitimized by the white dominant culture. Like some of the events that I've been to, you know, it was like, oh, you know, these are our family recipes, or, you know, we grew up eating different parts of the animal, or we talked about being connected to the land and eating a whole variety of food. Then it had to be legitimized first by the chefs that have the certifications, or they're from New York. And so that's been the disconnect that I've seen, is that there seems to be kind of the
gourmetified, or I call it foodist, kind of elitist dynamic that's evolved. And like Nicole has written a lot about, you know, a lot of times it's reflective of the women that have slaved in the kitchen, or primarily, you know, black women that have served up the food, but it's the white men that are paid as professionals. And so I see that disconnect a lot with the new ethnic popularity of food, but at the same time, it's like we're...
It's odd to hear some guy who didn't grow up with that food telling you that it's not authentic.
Exactly, and then someone to tell me that I can't be authentically Southern. Like, they hear Chinese Southern Belle, and they're like, you can't be Southern. And so that dissonance is what is, I think, is an opportunity for us to broaden the conversation around authenticity, who's defining it, and who says I can't or cannot be authentic, or what foods can or can't be authentic, and as well as Chinese-American food. You know, I mean, I've had people constantly ask me, you know, where can I find authentic food? And, you know, Chinese takeout must not be authentic food. But I'm saying, well, actually, it's part of the Chinese-American experience. It is part of our Asian-American history that Chinese food like chow mein and chop suey are actually authentic to us, but maybe not to someone in China.
Right. All right, let's hear...
As Americans.
Let's hear actress Rosie Perez, if we're going to be fully honest, as Natalie said. She was a guest on WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful, and she is Puerto Rican of descent. So this is her talking about the assumptions people make about what she will like.
You know, it's so insulting when people go, do you still eat rice and beans? They wouldn't ask an American, you know, do you still eat meat and potatoes? You know, it's just, why would you ask me that? Is that what you see? You don't see me as a human being first. You see me as rice and beans first. And so therefore, that's why it's insulting.
I wonder, Nicole, how far that goes in terms of what you're expected to cook. And I say that as the descendant of an African-American musician who was expected to write so-called black music for all his life. Does it also affect what you are expected to make?
Definitely, and what I'm expected to write about. I think there are people always look at me and think, oh, you write about food, you're a cookbook author. Tell me about the fried chicken. And I'm happy to do that. But, you know, we are more than just fried chicken. And, you know, when you look at the African-American or the black experience in the South, it's full of seafood. It's full of all kinds of things. And you have the Caribbean. So, yeah, people do expect me to write about black food always. And I'm happy to do that because there are not a lot of voices or a lot of people doing that. But I do think there's room for me to talk about other things. Not only me, other people to talk about stuff beyond just black foodways.
Dennis, what difference does this make? It's not that, you know, just because you're a white guy, you can't taste good food or good cooking, right? Mm-hmm. So in the end, what difference does it make who's writing about the restaurants, who's writing about the cookbooks?
I think a lot of it has to do also with how much exposure a person gets, or a lot of magazines and websites that are, I guess, seen as legitimate, or a lot of them are white-owned, so they think that those bigger magazines are the ones that make it a legitimate comment on what a good dish is, or who makes good, whatever it could be. And I think asking those people who do specialize in certain cuisine, they don't have to be necessarily directly from that country, but to know it and knowing their background, they can specialize in that way as well. It doesn't have to always be about race. But honestly, I had an interesting discussion with one of my cousins, and we're from Jamaica. And I'm asking him, what is the best Jamaican food in Atlanta? You know what I mean? And I'm taking his word a little more because he is from Jamaica. And I think that's one way to go about doing it. And also, American food sometimes is kind of tailored towards not as creative as palates sometimes. So, like, maybe spices.
That's a nice way to put it.
Boring plan.
Yeah. And, you know, Thai food can be kind of dumbed down a little bit to kind of not be as spicy. You know what I mean? Those kind of things. But you just got to kind of dig in the crates. And that's kind of a fun thing itself, is to find those really, really authentic spots that make the food that is reflective of the country they represent.
And here's, I think, would be a really big problem, Natalie, is because to a certain extent, you know, they always call it an educated palate, right? I mean, if you haven't grown up in a culture and therefore haven't grown up eating certain kinds of peppers and certain kinds of spices, it may take you a while to realize what it tastes like when those are cooked properly, right? But you don't get a second chance at that review.
No, I mean, You know, in the end, it's almost like if the food is good, you know, because we're constantly evolving. If you see food as an embodiment of the people and culture, as I do, you know, you have very rarely you're going to have a culture that is formed in a vacuum. Right? We've got so many different influences, and the influences are exciting and tasty and spicy. Why dismiss it just because we might not think it's authentic, or because, I mean, I've been to China and it's been authentically bad Chinese food there, right? I mean, because we don't want MSG, we want healthy, fresh vegetables, you know, things like that that we've adapted here in America. Or there might be Cuban influences or even Jewish or Spanish influences, and it makes it very exciting, and it's reflective of who we are in our cooking and what we've become as Americans. So, I mean, I think it's just an interesting, really dynamic kind of concept if you see food as being an embodiment of our diverse, you know, history. So I think to say, oh, because you didn't grow up in China, you know, your dumpling recipe isn't as authentic, or you are Chinese and speak Mandarin, so you can't cook a really good fried chicken and collard greens, right? I think it's we're going to be missing out, you know, on really good food.
That's
but
a great
at the same
point.
Time, you have to honor the traditions, right? Because, all right, to put bacon in sushi, for example, or to put something really kind of non-authentic, right, into a dish like sushi or in dumplings, are you being sacrilegious? Are you dishonoring that tradition? You know, and I think it's an important question to ask ourselves as people and for the food.
I agree. We have about a minute left. And Nicole, I wanted to bring you into this because it kind of depresses me to hear Rosie Perez say, would you ask an American, because she's an American? Maybe this is about just expanding. I mean, chop suey is an American dish. Mm-hmm. Maybe we just need to expand what American is when it comes to food.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I think that there are so many people, home cooks, restaurateurs, food writers, who are really doing great food and honoring the heritage of different cultures. And I just feel like there just needs to be a shift to those folks, because I think people are doing it. It's not all negative. I feel like the last few months or the last year or so, we've been talking about the lack of, and there is a true lack of, but for sure, there are people who are celebrating our food in ways that totally uplift it. And I do feel like the tide is changing, and that we can move this conversation forward and move this whole thing around diversity and food forward if we just look at the folks who are not being talked about. Go to blogs and stuff. Yeah.
A little optimism to end the conversation. Nicole Taylor, author of the Up South Cookbook, host of the Hot Grease podcast, food writer Natalie King, also owner of the company Chinese Southern Belle, and Atlanta beer and food writer Dennis Byron, hosts a video web series and blog called Cruisin' for a Bruisin'. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And that's it for the show today. But as always, we want to hear from you. Do you think there needs to be more diversity in food writing? Where do you get your culinary inspiration from? Tell us your thoughts at 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News.